Did you just burp?
Yeah, it happens.
It happens a lot.
A lot.
Okay.
Welcome so I guess to, I can.
Yeah, so.
Welcome.
Welcome to the pod.
Welcome to the pod. Welcome to the pod. Wait, hold on. That's not it. We can't say welcome to the pod like three times in a row.
This pod is a pod about podding, and then we're gonna welcome.
We're
someone
just
to
doing
the, pod.
The pod's work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'd like to welcome our first winemaker guest, Tracy Brandt of Donkey and Goat.
Hi guys. Thanks for having me.
Do you consider yourself of Berkeley? Is it Donkey and Goat of Berkeley, or where do you consider the home base?
What is the Shire name?
Yeah.
I think Berkeley is probably the best descriptor. I mean, we also claim the foothills, El Dorado,
yeah,
and Mendocino.
Is it hard for people because there's a separation between the vineyards and the winemaking facility to like sort of declare a home base?
Hold on. I think you're jumping ahead.
I'm just going in.
Just dig in.
Okay, well, so for our listeners that are not as familiar with Donkey and Goat Wines as obviously Adam is.
That's what I forgot.
So Tracy and her husband, Jared, they started Donkey and Goat in 2004.
Holy shit.
And they kind of started, they were part of the New California movement, and they're based in Berkeley, and they kind of, it's like a industrial, like kind of garage situation that you turned into your winery.
Yeah, more or less. I don't know if it's a garage, but the
not
block
a garage.
Was a, actually it was an ink factory.
Oh, wow.
From like the early 1900s, our unit was built in 1905 until about the 80s. And then we refurbished it and turned it into a working winery.
It's so cool because like there's this block in Berkeley where it looks very industrial. And then in the middle of it, you know, you have Donkey and Goat, and right next door you have Brock Cellars. So it's really cool that Donkey and Goat and Tracy, who's here with us today, they kind of started this, you know, movement. Like urban winemaking.
Yeah, were you guys the first in Northern California? Like, when did Dirty and Rowdy and Brock and
Chris Brock Cellars started? I think a year or two after us. Chris used to be around the corner from us on Camellia Street, and in 2013, I think moved next door. Hardy, Doug, you might be able to help me here, but I think started around 2007, 8, 9.
All right.
Sounds about right.
So you guys really were...
We're a little older.
Pioneers, though, in some way.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we, you know, for us, we were two kids working in technology. 9/11 happened. My job, my company more or less went away. And we decided to take a pause and move to France and learn how to make wine from Eric Texier.
And that's crazy.
I know. He didn't know that. And I was like, yeah, dude.
How did you end up... So 2001... And then a handful of years later, how did you end up? Because even at that time, natural wine and like someone like Eric Texier and sort of it was still relatively new to the market. It existed, it was out, but it wasn't necessarily a big topic. How did you find that? How did you even come across those wines?
Yeah, no, your point's valid. I mean, really what we see today is kind of the various organizations that support the natural wine community really came about, you know, 2007, 8, 9, 10.
Yeah.
So back then, we didn't know the word natural wine. We had Eric's wines from, I think at the time it was Estate Wines Limited, had the Dresdner portfolio in California, and just loved his wines. We had kind of every chance we had a vacation, gone to the Rhone, gone to Burgundy, you know, as you do when, you know, you work 100 hours a week and need to get away for a couple weeks. And when we decided, and actually it wasn't we really, this was Jared's whole thing to learn how to make wine. At the time we were dating, and I was thinking about learning how to make cheese, to be honest.
Oh wow, like Caroline from Loughlin Farm.
But long story short is we decided because of the preference of at the time we were drinking far more wines out of Europe than we were drinking California wine. We were always about the marriage of food and wine. So the idea of like the big cocktail or the, you know, 14% extracted just wasn't our thing. So when Jared was looking at a sabbatical, we're like, well, why don't we go to France? And we contacted Joe Dresner, and I called him up completely out of the blue. We're like, hey, I want to go work for Eric Texier. Can I get his email? And he's like, well, who the fuck are you? If you knew Joe, you can appreciate that. And he's like, no, but you can fax him. Because this is 2001.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's no way. And if it was an email, it was like at hotmail.biz or something.
Right. Well, totally. Most winemakers in Europe still have at Hotmail email addresses. So, and they're bad at email. So I can't even imagine how bad they would be at fax.
Actually, Laurence, his wife, runs the business side. And she was very prompt. But at the time, Eric had never had an intern. So when we kind of reached out, the response was, this might be a good idea, but not until I meet you.
Mm.
Fair enough.
Fair,
So this was back in the day of, you know, the financial...
Wait, he didn't want strangers just coming to his house and staying with him for a couple months? Whatever.
What have I been doing wrong? I've just been inviting strangers off the street to come and live with me for so long.
Do you want to intern? Do you want to learn how to do me? Sorry to interrupt.
No.
So
basically we met, we hit it off, and we moved and worked for him for the 2002 harvest.
That is incredible.
Came back and started Donkey Goat in 2004.
And then there was as wine is, it's this big, it's a forever learning curve. I was going to say a big learning curve, but it's something that, right, you never really truly master. It's something that is constantly changing and evolving. So over the course of how many years did it take before you guys felt like you weren't just, maybe never, maybe you always felt like you were good at what you were doing?
But no, the reverse. I would say I never feel like I know everything or even close to. The amount of things that, you know, because you make wine, the amount of variables in play.
Yeah.
And you only get one shot a year.
Yeah.
And you have all these things that you want to do or want to try or want to learn. And then you have just the things you kind of want to do again because, wow, that was really good.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And then there's also the things that you have to do. You know, like it's not like all these things you want to do and need to, you know, like I can't imagine how hard it is to like have these things that I know, like even in, you know, as a writer, like there's so many things I want to do, but like to balance that with like what already has to be done. You know, just like
the wines that people love and you don't want to stop making because they'll get mad at you. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in speaking of wine, tell us a little bit about these wines you brought us today, Tracy.
Sure. So I brought you, I was saying the Australian is my inspiration and the Magnum because I hear you guys like, you know, big bottles.
No, we have a rule where we drink one bottle of wine so that the Magnum is perfect.
That's what I thought. There's four of us. I figured we needed more to go around.
Sorry, I was fixing that. I'm like,
There's Doug. He's sitting in the back, Doug is being creepy.
like he normally is in my life.
Yeah.
I'm teasing. I love Doug some. But so this is a Domaine Lucci, which is kind of a part of the Lucy Margaux family. It's a Pinot Gris. It says Pinot Gris on the back. It's a gorgeous, absolutely stunning coral orange color. And it has their famous handmade, like, fabric-y, cool labels.
Yeah, like woven-y.
Their labels kill me. I know.
I know.
They're gorgeous.
It's gorgeous.
So textural.
And then the Magnum that Tracy brought is one of hers. Is their Pinot Gris. So it's gonna be really exciting to try these next to each other. So Tracy, you said that this wine inspires you.
So yeah, there were several inspiration points. But
I also just keep pouring until
it's delicious. Thank you, by the way, for bringing.
Yeah, thank
wines.
You so much.
I got this from Aaron Healy a couple years ago over at Ruby Wine.
Another thing that people don't know about this podcast is Marissa and I started it so people would bring us wine.
Hey.
Yeah.
I can think of a lot of worse reasons that you would have started it.
My husband was like, so you're spending $1,500 a month on wine. Let's fucking let's figure this out, kiddo. And I'm like, what?
We'll start a podcast. And then we'll just make people bring it to us.
And hopefully get that Casper money.
Yeah.
I need a new mattress.
I sleep on a Casper mattress.
Don't say that. Then we're not going to get
free never
ones.
Been on a Casper mattress.
Thank you. Tracy, please go on about that Pinot Gris.
From mattresses to Pinot Gris, that's a...
From Pinot Gris to mattress is usually how it works.
Exactly.
Hey.
Cheers to that.
Yeah.
My husband's like, God, this is why my husband doesn't listen to the podcast.
There you go, Doug. Doug, you can also drink some Pinot Gris and get on a mattress.
Is it appropriate if I snort?
Yes.
Yeah.
Snorting, burping, no farting.
We haven't had farting yet.
Ben's only heard me fart once in 9 years we've been together.
Seriously?
So,
are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding.
So that's
insane. Not eat a lot of garlic.
actually, a ton of garlic because Ben. All right, wait a minute. All right.
No, welcome to the new podcast. It's called How Do We Get Marissa to Fart? On microphone.
The last one was Welcome to Marissa Doesn't Brush Her Teeth.
That's true.
I did brush my teeth today. So, anyways, Pinot Gris from Domaine Lucci.
So, you said to bring something that inspired. So, we started, or really, the Pinot Gris was really kind of my project. Jared and I do both make the wines, contrary to many questions I've had over the years. So, do you actually go to the cellar? Because
you're a woman. I know how that feels.
Yeah. So we won't go down that path.
No, we're going to keep it positive today.
We're going to keep it positive. But the
Hashtag
Pinot Gris,
feminism.
The Pinot Gris is one of my babies. Somewhere in 2012-13, started thinking about making this. Had lots of different wines along the way that inspired me. I love the Lucy Margaux wines. They are always electric, I think it was the first word I said.
Yeah.
Alive. Definitely a sense of purity. I have had a few maybe that were off, but largely they're extremely well made. And yeah, I love this wine.
I really love this wine too. I've had a bunch of their wines and I have never really had any problems with them. Aside from their Frizzante, I had a couple problems with not being
Frizzante.
Yeah, not being Frizzante. Yeah, that happens. But other than that, you know, I found their wines to be extremely delicious. Like you said, I think electric is a perfect descriptor for all of them. They have a wonderful acidity to them. Even the reds are just very they're bright. Like they're just
very
bright.
They're stunning wines.
And there's something similar in the sense that I think Australia has a person people think of a specific like a certain style of wine that comes from Australia. And there's these new sort of Lucy Margaux and
Patrick Sullivan.
Like a new group. And there's a lot of them.
Yeah, the other, is it called The Other Right is the other one that I was thinking of. And I just, The Other Right. And then there's another one I just had,
there's
too.
The Yeti and the coconut.
I haven't had that one yet.
But there's
that sounds like a Disney cartoon TV show. I don't think it's like ready for like Lilo and Stitch status, but...
But there's like this new movement happening, and you were part of this sort of this new movement that happened in California. Do you see some similarities? Or, I mean, it seems like Australia is finding its own little path in this new movement. Like, there's a lot of, you can kind of taste the new Australia a little bit.
Absolutely.
And do you think that there's this, like, I don't know, I'm trying to ask, like, what makes the new California, do you consider yourself new California? First of all,
wow, that was a lot, Adam.
I'm gonna edit it, so it's just gonna have me say, "Do you consider yourself New California?"
You know, it was interesting because when John's book came out, we were enormously excited to be a part of it. I thought it was amazing to see kind of the documentation of what I've referred to kind of as the pendulum shift that's happened since we've been making wine.
Yeah,
when we started, you know, we always said, you know, we're swimming upstream here. We have two kids that have no formal training. We have a crazy name. We make, and this is back in 2004, you know, high acid, food-friendly wines in ways that, you know, most of the people we encounter stateside are telling us we're stupid. Like, people tell us we're dumb to do native ferments and all sorts of other things. But slowly, the pendulum starts to swing. First, I think, in a style within California. So you definitely saw what I would say the sommelier influence that's, you know, hey, people, if you want to see your wines on wine list where it's going to be paired with food, there's certain things about this wine that are required. Acidity, alcohol less than 16%, et cetera.
Which seems so crazy that, like, that would even need to be, like, a less than 16% needs to even be said. Like,
hey,
I want to
get fucked up. I'm not drinking for...
Yeah.
Like...
It's not
for pleasure. It's to get fucked up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway,
you want to high five that one, Doug? Yeah.
But what was interesting about the book is, I think two things were happening, right? So, you know, the composition of what the wines were that were kind of coming out of California had dramatically shifted, you know, in the 10 years from the book to when we started. And in addition, you had the natural wine thing, for lack of a better way to say it, coming together where you have, you know, organizations and winemakers out of Europe, you know, since 2007, 8, 9, and then slowly that starts to inform what's going on in America and the conversation around organic, biodynamic, and now natural wine. And the book comes out, and there was kind of an immediate, oh, all these wines are natural wines. And actually, they weren't. And they, not to say they're bad wines in any stretch of the imagination, but it was interesting to see how that kind of had to be unpacked and be like, okay, there's this thing called the New California Wine, which is not regardless of farming, but is definitely a little bit bigger than that. And then there's also the natural wine movement. And these two things have intersected, I think, in exciting ways. Some people get on their, you know, high horse about it and complain. But I think it's great to see the shift in general and getting people to understand that wine is such a sense of, it brings together a sense of communal activity when you put it on a table with food that does not happen much as we like to get fucked up in a cocktail glass. It's not the same thing.
I always say that, or like in my book, I was like,
"I just said fucked." By the way,
you could say fucked as much as you want. No, all of our pods have an E next to them because it's all explicit. I cuss far too much, but it's funny because I always in my book I said, you know, it's wine is a shared subjective experience. You know, it's that's why you say that you share a bottle of wine. It's because we are all tasting the same thing in the glass, you know, from the same bottle, and we can all share this experience rather than sharing a bottle of vodka where we all could take it a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that this wine is so exciting and fun, and I'm really glad you brought this. And also, to going back to what you're saying about, like, you know, the New California thing, you know, I think of it so much bigger than, I mean, obviously, Bonnet coined the term and has the book about it. But I kind of see it as, like, you know, when I think of, like, the New California, I think of it as, like, you know, there was a group that all kind of came that has, like, kind of come up together. I think that you all share a similar, if they are intervening, if you will, to believe that they're doing it for the best of the wine. And I believe that that's sort of like a New California thing too. Like that sort of mentality of like, it doesn't have to be X, Y, Z. It can be a little bit of, you know, also A, B, and C maybe.
How, I mean, do you guys go into your winemaking with, you definitely have some standards and stuff, but like, are you pretty open-minded?
She's like, some standards. She's like, actually, we have no standards.
No, but when you're doing your winemaking, do you have to, like you said, it's a teenager. I don't know if that was recorded or not, but you, like in the winery, so you have to dance a little bit, right? You have to see how things are going and make decisions based on that.
Yeah, no, I think, there was a lot there.
Yeah, sorry.
No, it's good.
I'm trying not to interrupt as much, so then I just keep it all inside,
blah, blah, blah. But to start, I think, you know, definitions. So when we think about organic and biodynamic and natural, you know, definitions are confusing.
Yes.
Right? Because even when you just, you know, look at the word organic, something that's a little bit more defined, and you look at the difference between the United States and Europe or the EU.
Absolutely.
You know, it's crazy. And then you talk about natural wine where, again, there are commonly held beliefs and there are definitions, but there's not a universal one. For us, just since I talked about definitions, you know, we're farming everything organically and biodynamically. We are largely not certified. We're okay with that. We do have some that are. We have a Demeter certified. Actually, the Pinot Gris is Demeter certified from Filigreen Farm. Linda Vista Chardonnay is organically certified, but largely we're not.
You guys don't put that on the label either, right?
Because you can't. So here's where it gets messy. I can't say made with organic grapes unless the vineyard is certified.
Right.
Yeah, which is costly.
I also am a small business that wears a lot of hats, and we print labels in a way that doesn't allow me to be very nimble, meaning I print like my whole year, you know, in February.
Right.
So interesting.
The point is a lot of those certifications require lab work
right
before the and with the cola. You know what
So
no, we don't. We have over the years occasionally said hand harvested organic grapes, and actually the back label on Filigreen does say they're biodynamic, but generally we just say hand harvested grapes because of the regulations around.
Yeah.
But for us again, that's how we're farming. And then in the winery, you know, we are nothing added save sulfur. And sulfur is not always, and it's always a little, but when we do use it, but we definitely are not dogmatic to the point of never using sulfites, for example.
Yeah, and I'm like, I'm in that, personally, I'm in that boat. Like, I would much rather a winemaker add 10 parts per million for it to be a drinkable wine versus not.
But there are definitely are some things that, to your point on the winemaking, that we won't do. So, for example, we, like any natural winemaker, have had problems with Pediococcus or mouse. And
Pipicaca?
You've been hanging out with your baby that, for far too long.
Is that the official name now?
Pedicacus.
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 I like it. I like it. And you know, there's times when it's been such a problem that the only way to deal with it was with technology that we don't feel philosophically we want to do.
It's really,
so we dumped the wine.
It's really, because what I was about to say is that, like, I've never had a mousy wine of yours.
Yeah, we're pretty stringent when it comes to what we put in bottle. So we, you know.
Good for you.
Do believe firmly in not having a customer buy our wine simply because it's natural and then stand high on our haunches and say, well, yeah, it tastes bad, but it's natural. That's not our kind of starting point. Our starting point is ultimately wine should be delicious. And I hope people care about, you know, the stewardship we're providing to the winemaking process in the vineyard, and that we care about the environment and its macro and micro level. We care about what we put in our body and what our kids put in their body and all of that good stuff. But ultimately, I want the wine to be delicious.
Yeah. So,
inspiration, not copy. No. Okay.
So now we have opened this beautiful magnum of Donkey and Goat Pinot Gris. Ramado, which, oh, Doug informed us about.
Yeah, via text message. He was like, hey, you fucking idiots. Ramado means copper in Italian. Dumb pieces of shit. I think that's verbatim what he said.
I didn't agree or disagree. I don't think I said anything about the Ramado. I think I just let, I never heard that term really about rosé. So, anyways.
He texted me.
I think it's rosado.
It was 2:30 in the morning.
Did he actually text you?
And he texted me and he was like, hey, you dumb ignorant piece of shit. Ramado means copper. You're fucking stupid. I hope you die.
Well, then I really, I guess.
And
wow.
Then, and then there was.
Well,
a,
and then, but then, but, and then by, and then I threw some salt on the wound by being like, hey, Doug just texted me, and then I sent Adam a screenshot of Doug texting me with like, you dumb fucking fucks.
Yeah.
How dare you have a podcast about wine and
don't
say
text
Ramado?
Me at night,
Doug,
okay? And I still don't get
a this was at like 9 a.m. He was like, you dumb fucking
this is
fuck.
Why you don't have a microphone. No, I'm joking. He was very nice. He was like, you guys need to start fact checking more. And we're like, we need to stop drinking as much.
And I was like, do we have
no,
to do
you
either?
Do not need to stop. Yeah. No.
So speaking about drinking more, so we are now opening the Donkey and Goat Ramado Pinot Gris from Philo Green Farm in Anderson Valley. Your Pinot Gris has always been really exciting to me. And in general, just a little background on like my affinity for Donkey and Goat. Back when I first started blogging in like 2011 about wine, Tracy was one of the first winemakers. I think you were the first winemaker to be like nice to me and be like, you should come. Well, no, and just be like, you should come visit. Like, oh my gosh, you know, you were very just like super sweet and like lovely to me, even though I was like literally a blogger that knew nothing about wine and was like working in an ocarina factory. And
I love that you worked in an ocarina factory.
I know, it's intense. I'm one of my many, many crazy jobs.
Do you
jobs.
Have any of those ocarinas?
I gave them all away because I got, we don't need to get into the ocarina story at this point. I did have like 50 ocarinas.
What is an ocarina?
Like the little flutes, the
like
little clay flute.
Clay flute.
Okay.
So so drinking this Pinot Gris and the first time I had this wine, it was so interesting to me because, you know, Pinot Gris is another word for Pinot Grigio, right? I mean, you had like a concerned look on your face. I'm like fact checking. I'm like, have I been wrong?
There is no varietal that is called Pinot Grigio, correct, Doug?
Well, people call it Pinot Grigio.
I know, but you're right. No, that's what I'm saying. There's not a varietal. It's Pinot Grigio style.
Yes.
It's like Shiraz and Syrah.
Shiraz. Yeah, so that wine was so interesting to me because I'd never seen a Pinot Gris that this color. Like, I'd never seen really, and while I hate the term orange wine with vengeance as a category, thank you. My campaign against orange wine as a category will never end. But this is an actual orange colored wine, and I had never seen a Pinot Gris this color. And I never really liked Pinot Gris. I didn't like Pinot Grigio. And this wine kind of really changed how I felt about Pinot Gris. And like also it was one of the wines that became a wine that changed how I thought about wine in general, in terms of like, you know, varieties are at the hands of the winemaker, and there is so much to be done with a variety, you know, that you may never know of if you just like never venture outside of your grocery store where it all looks like straw yellow, you know, and it's like this chemical, we don't need to get into how much I hate that shit, but I just love this wine and I'm really excited that you brought it for us. So
well, thank you.
Tell us a little bit about it now that I've just, you know, gushed a bit.
Yeah. And to your point, this is a great illustration of the belief that there's so many very, very, very small, even delicate steps, changes, modifications make such a difference. So we started making, or I started making this in 2014.
I say I because
it was in fact my baby.
You're like, this is
my husband
shit.
Makes tons. The pet Nat's his baby, and that's obviously and wildly successful. But this was mine.
You're like, it's okay.
It's okay.
The pet Nat's fine, but the Pinot Gris.
The Pinot Gris man is really where it's at.
Bombaleo. Bombalea.
But no, I wanted to, you know, after kind of thinking about it, I wanted to make, you know, a skin contact Pinot Gris that was in concrete, because I believed concrete would be the right vessel, but I honestly could have tried it in wood.
I'm glad you didn't.
But I am too. there's a little less permeability in the concrete, which I think is a good thing. It keeps it a little bit more, slightly more angular, if you will.
I think that's a perfect word for
I'm
it.
I'm looking for, you know, a balance between a white and a skin contact wine. It's not red, but definitely with tannin and savory elements that, you know, are not if I had direct pressed this. But what's interesting is for the first couple of years, so I made this the first time in 2014. There was actually three versions made from the Pinot Gris we pick and grow at Filigreen Farm. So we did something called Blanca, Ramado, and then hard press. And actually what we're drinking is hard press.
But it says Ramado on it.
It does, absolutely. Okay. Hard press was an additional.
Oh, wait.
Additive.
Oh, here we go. Here we go. There's a stamp on it that says hard press. I love that there's a stamp on it.
And that was done by Isabel, the 13-year-old.
That's because they print
their
labels.
While eating an ice cream cone, which I yelled at her for.
Wait,
severely.
So she was like, have, so that's like, sticky ice cream cone hands?
I was like, I just thought that Doug jizzed
half
on this on the way here.
Were like decorated with an ice cream. I kid you not.
That's amazing that you have your that's
believe in child labor.
I was gonna say that's what sort of we love about this movement, right? Is that we have people
child
under
labor.
The age of 15 doing. They have small hands. They're better at doing things like this.
Lord knows, I almost cut my
finger. She was like 11 at the time, or 12. But
so, and I completely agree. This wine right now is tasting so fantastic. So right now we're drinking the 2016 Pinot Gris, and it is. I think the. It's exactly how you described it, like, and what you want from it. And I think it's actually, I mean, if you're into skin contact wines, I think this is sort of a perfect example of one, because it's like you said, it's very savory, but very angular. And also while there's tannins, it's not overpowering. Like I could drink this. I kind of judge all wines by whether or not I could drink them without food, which
mm-hmm.
is like the opposite of what you were
saying
earlier. Well, no, but also too, like as a writer, like I can't be like, all right, well, I got to order myself some steak to drink with this wine. You know,
generally, that's a tannin discussion. You don't want the tannins to be so overpowering.
Absolutely.
I totally get
and
it.
So this is just, I love this wine because it is extremely well balanced, and it does have the possibility to be, you know, I could drink this with a steak if I wanted to, and like I'd be fine with it.
Well, what's interesting too, I think, just to give another layer, so this
insane.
Is in Magnum. I bottled 18 Magnum cases. This year, actually, this next year I did a little bit more. But this is what some winemakers literally throw away. So just let that sit for a second, right? Because you guys just said you like it.
Because that's what the hard press is.
Right. So there is a belief, and I get some of it when we talk about white wines, but that the free run juice is the holy grail, and the beginning and the end should be discarded. And I'm talking about when you're pressing the wine, so you put the you know, depending on what we're talking about, the macerated skins in this case after 5 days, or a whole cluster if you're talking about a white wine that's direct press, or macerated entirely if it's a red wine. But regardless, there's a belief that once you start the press run, the very last part is to be thrown away, because it is too tannic, it's too heavy in sediment. There's lots of reasons, and I decided to kind of flip that upside down, separate the juice as if I was going to throw it away, but instead bottle it by itself in Magnum. Because I think it's kind of the best part. I love this. When I put this next to the main bottling, which is also wonderful, but it's less, it's a little lighter. It has a little less on the tannin and the grip.
It is a little lighter. It's interesting because I was like trying to figure out what the difference is, because I am, your Pinot Gris is one of my favorite California wines. I drink it pretty regularly. But now I was like, oh, maybe it's because it's a Magnum.
And for the non-French speaking people, Gris does mean gray, which is a specific type of grape. Obviously, Pinot Gris is its own variety, but a gray grape is one that does have color in the skin, but typically people make them in white wines. But when you do skin contact, there's that, not only the added color from just that process, but also the added color from the grayness. They call it's really like a...
It's like a weird like yellow, gray, green thing.
Yeah.
Well, there's a Pinot Gris, there's a Grenache Gris.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Several varietals have a red, white, and pink version.
And so that pink is just, it just means there's a little bit of skin color.
Yeah,
to the grape.
I mean, exactly.
So speaking about like how you have it labeled on here as hard press, and I just got a lot of your new wines, and excuse me, talking about burping. I only said excuse me because Tracy's here. Usually I'm like, bleh.
Yeah.
I'm Rick Sanchez.
She's like, hold on, turn my mic up.
I'm burping.
Turn up my microphone.
You'll never catch me farting, but man, do I love burping. Queefing on the other end.
I'm just kidding. Oh my God, I do not. I knew you were going to go there. I knew it.
Yeah, I was informed recently about the phenomenon of
queefing? The phenomenon of queefing?
Oh, no. Sometimes a woman's...
Okay.
Where is this going, Doug? No, I have to hear where this is going. Doug, where is this going? No.
It's the phenomenon where a woman may have a small fart, and yet, based upon their position of seating, it will come out the front and kind of come through...
What the fuck are you talking?
Okay, are you saying the small intestine is connected to the vaginal cavity?
No, I'm not saying that at
He's
all.
He's saying with the direction of airflow.
The direction of airflow, sometimes it gets...
Well,
it goes north instead of south.
But what is that?
I snorted.
Is that what you're saying?
Oh, so the title of the podcast, sometimes I fart from the front.
Okay. As I was saying before we started talking about
corn farts. Did you ever know anybody? Had a bunch of siblings?
No. And we're shutting this down now to get to the thing that I'm excited to talk about. Jesus Christ.
Labeling, transparency. Yes, I know where you're going.
Okay. I know. I'm trying to get there. God.
I got it.
So
Hold on, let's do a hard reset then. So that I have
hard press, okay, hard reset.
Everybody get your giggles out. Yeah, no more queef talk.
Just so that I can
I burped. I just said I burped.
She burped from the front.
Just out my mouth? Like, where else does a burp go?
It's a burp.
Well, that's still out if you do it out the nose.
Burping out your nose is the worst.
Okay, so, all right, time out. Time out. No more queef jokes. No more farting from the front, Doug. All right, we're resetting. Speaking about hard press and the stamp that you have here on this Magnum, I've always really liked this about your labels, that you have things right on the front. It says unfined, unfiltered. Sometimes it says one or the other. And then I just got this new wine that I've never seen from you guys, the Gigi. And this one says Sansouf. Or do you say Sansoufre?
I think it's Sansouf.
I think it's Sansouf.
If it's a French word, you drop the last 8 letters.
See,
Sansouf.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. So it's just, it's actually Sansouf.
It's funny because with Sansouf is the one that normally I can like just spell the words and I can't say them, but Sansouf, it's the opposite. That's fun. Okay, just learn.
It's the older generation's way to say 00.
Exactly. Yeah. So Sansouf. Sansouf definitely means no added sulfur, no added anything. So quick question. It's not going to be quick at all, but I've always loved the way that you guys are very, very upfront and transparent about what you guys do in your wines on the label on the front. And I know that you, earlier in the podcast, we talked about how you had, you sometimes say hand harvested grapes or whatever on the back. But what was it that made you guys decide to be really up? Like, it's literally upfront on the front of your labels. It says unfined, unfiltered. And I think that that's really great in moving forward with the natural wine movement. I think that this sort of labeling and transparency is going to be extremely important for consumers to be able to purchase natural wines and understand it. So what kind of prompted you guys to take this route?
Well, honestly, the Unfined Unfiltered has been on our front label from the day, from 2003. We actually did print labels for the 2003 vintage that was illegal.
We're telling everyone.
Don't tell. But yeah, I mean, and it started out, to be honest, because again, back then, it wasn't necessarily a badge of honor. It's kind of like, you know, when organic wines first hit the market, you know, they garnered less money and generally were deemed to be inferior to a conventional counterpart. We did it more as a, I'm a big believer in kind of under promise, over deliver. So make sure someone who buys my wine and is about to open it knows, hey, wait, this thing was not fined and filtered. So when it's cloudy,
it's bad.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was really in 2003, 2004, you know, for years, really largely the impetus, not so much to be like, hey, we're making our wines in a weird way that nobody understands or cares about, but more be warned, this is not going to be clear. It's not necessarily going to be pretty. There might be large chunks of tartrates in it. It's okay.
It's supposed to be this
way.
Yeah,
exactly. That said, as we evolved, we did, you mentioned, to start putting our ingredient list on the back label. And we've done that since, I think, 2014. And that's one thing that I also, like the petrochemical industry divorcing from the wine industry, feel really strongly about. I don't understand why anybody out there making low intervention, minimal natural wine doesn't proactively go ahead and list the ingredients.
Well, I think that that's, for me as someone that writes for the consumer, and I consider myself a consumer first and foremost before anything else. Yes, I'm a wine writer, but I'm a consumer mostly, as most people probably know. And as someone that writes about, like, to help the consumer understand what natural wines are and trying to like guide them, mm-hmm. you know, having those words on there actually means so much, because a consumer can pick up a bottle of wine and be like, I don't know what the fuck any of this is. I don't, and if it, especially if it's a domestic wine, because with imported wines, you can look at the importer and kind of be like, okay, I know that Selection Massal does all natural wines, or okay, I know Louis Dresner's wines, I can trust those. Mm-hmm. But with domestic wines, you don't have that.
No.
So I just think it's so important and incredible. And I wish more, I agree with you. I think that the future of natural wine, if we want this to not be a trend and we want it to be actually economically sustainable as well as environmentally sustainable, is to move in this direction. I think it's incredible.
Well, Paul Draper at Ridge has been doing it for years.
Yes.
We copied him, absolutely.
And he's really
and
honest.
Graham,
Paul Draper will even say, like, we added water, or we
absolutely.
Like, he's completely transparent. And I think that transparency is what makes, even if you, some people might consider some of the stuff that he does in the conventional vein, at least he's honest and really open about
he's
what
extreme.
He's doing.
Well, that's my, I mean, I don't believe our job as members of the natural wine community or a natural wine winemaker are to shame others. That is not the point. The point is transparency. The point is caring about the planet and caring about our health. And if we make it so that it's so painful for other winemakers to say that they added water or to say that they added tartaric acid or whatnot, then we're just going to propagate a whole system where people are either afraid to be transparent or outright lie.
Yeah.
And that's not the point.
Which I think is what they're currently doing.
It's omission of guilt. It's or
well, not in the natural wine movement, but I mean in the more conventional wine.
I don't know. I still believe that you need to have both a macro and a micro view, right? You need to think about the big picture and then understand what's happening kind of at a granular level. And, you know, transparency and honesty are a starting point. So, you know, we've done things over the years. We had a year in 2008 where everything was on fire and we could not solve the problem with some of our voodoo tricks that we tried in the natural realm, like shorter macerations and fining with grape leaves that were dehydrated. So we ultimately paid somebody to come in and use a reverse osmosis machine. And we did solve the problem. We then changed, put that whole wine, in Europe they would say declassified it, sold it as something else. People still to this day will say, I love that Mendocino Melange from 2008 under that other label. And I'm like, yeah, I hope that never happens again, but I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, again, honestly, it's still drinkable wine. It's just not what I like to do.
Totally. And also too, like, you know, as someone that is very familiar with your wines, like some of them say unfined and unfiltered, and then some of them just say unfined, or some of them just say unfiltered.
Occasionally, we've definitely had to filter for sugar issues.
And absolutely. when you filter, you said that you mentioned these dried grape leaves. This is, I've never heard, I did not know about this.
For years, and actually we still do, we tap Eric a lot of times. We'll say, hey, you know, we have this problem or blah, blah, blah. What do you think? What do you do? Because the man is extremely intelligent and
his wines are incredible.
And he's tried, he's also a scientist at heart. So he's experimented far broadly, far more broadly than we have. But yeah, it was a trick that came out of, I forgot what it was. It was a corollary problem in the Beaujolais where they were trying to filter something out. And one way to deal with it was by dehydrating grape leaves, turning it into basically a powder, which is what a fining agent is.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, it would attach to the protein that is smoke taint, which is what happens when a forest fire and a vineyard with fruit that's ready to be picked come in contact. And it did work. It had the negative impact that it kind of imparted a cranberry-like flavor to the wine, which was not necessarily what we were going for. But it did not entirely remove the problem of tasting the smoke. So that's why we...
So for example, like, let's say...
Did you try Febreze? That's very good at getting smoke taint out.
It's not good at getting dog smell out of cushions, though. I can tell you that much. So, for example, if one of your wines says... Let's say most of them say unfined and unfiltered.
Mm-hmm.
If one of them says unfined or just unfiltered, are there different methods that you use? You know, is the fine? Do you have a singular fining method, a singular filtering method that you use, or do you use, you know, different fining and filtering methods?
Well, we generally never fine. Times that we fine have been when we have had Pediococcus mouse problems and lysozyme will kill it. So we fine with lysozyme, which is, you know, not the end of the world, but again, it's not what we want to do. So we would certainly be honest about it.
Can you describe to our listeners what fining?
So fining is basically trying to remove something from the wine, and it's a very gentle. I mean, it is actually a very gentle process. The wine can often stay in the barrel or tank or wherever it is, and you add the fining agent, which sometimes is egg whites. Usually, it's going to be, or I think, always a powder form. Actually, that's not true. I think you can do a liquid. And it will kind of latch onto the particles you're trying to remove, drop them to the bottom. And so if we're in a barrel, for example, then when you remove the wine from barrel called racking,
yeah.
You basically leave the heavy sediment, including the thing you were trying to get out of the wine, at the bottom. As a result, it also does clarify the wine or make it clearer, and that's why it sometimes gets discussed as fining as a mechanism for clarity, but also it's a mechanism for correction of problem.
Yeah,
and it can potentially, in some people claim, strip flavors as well.
I think it does. No,
yeah,
question. I mean, generally, you know, it's kind of like cheese, right? Do you think you can taste the difference between pasteurized and unpasteurized cheese? Do you think you can taste the difference? You know,
yeah.
It just, you are slowly making it. It's like my rosé that we make. Over the years, we have
not a Ramato.
Not a Ramato. It's a Rosato. But we have less sediment than we used to, and a lot of people have asked us why over the last few years, because this has only been since about 2015, and it's because we now ferment dry and stainless and then move to barrel. The reason is largely driven by the fact that the wine doesn't like to go dry by February when we bottle it. But the added benefit, I guess, is that we do drop a lot of sediment because we fermented in one vessel, moved the wine to a second vessel, and a lot of that heavy sediment stayed in the tank and didn't go with us to barrel.
Yeah.
So there's, you know what I'm saying? There's things you can do.
Totally.
Along the way.
And then with your filtering, do you guys have like a specific, do you have like one type of filtering process that you like to use? Or
We don't filter. I mean, the
so most of them are, so.
We have filtered probably 3 times in the 15 years.
Okay.
Of making wine. And it was driven by a need of too much sugar left in the wine. And our ability to sterile filter was still somewhat questionable.
But also, and then still going on kind of this label thing, because I just love that you guys are so literally upfront about this stuff. With the Gigi, though, which I haven't tried yet, it's G, like the name of it is Gigi Sansouf. Mm-hmm. So,
For Glue Glue.
Okay.
Well, Glue Glue was the idea, and then it turns out, not turns out, but Jared's mother's name is Gigi. So when we were saying we should call it Gigi for Glue Glue, we're like, no, we should spell it out Gigi for Gigi.
And yeah. Then, yeah, so. Oh, I love that. Okay, great. That's so cool. And, but I mean, a lot of your wines are Sansouf.
No, actually, not really.
Not really? Okay.
The Pet Nats have never had anything but grapes. Occasionally the rosé, but generally we do add sulfur for the bottling.
Gotcha.
And that means, you know, we're, and to a question a long time ago, as a matter of practice, we're going to stay in the barrel or the vessels surly until we create the blend for bottling. So we're not racking a lot along the way.
Yeah.
And at that point, when we do move from the vessel to the tank for bottling, we are introducing a minor amount of sulfites. We are typically under 30 parts per million, and it is to protect us during the bottling.
Yeah, absolutely. In the future, like if you do other bottlings without that are Sansouf, are you going to be labeling it similarly? Or?
We will. Actually, it was funny because we had heard that it was really expensive to get the TTB to run the test and give us the cola, because you can't put a label on a bottle that doesn't say contain sulfite without providing the lab results. And turns out
I didn't know that you could even do. I thought that you always had to say contain sulfite.
You do. That's what I'm saying. You can't remove that.
Yeah.
And get the label approved. But turns out the federal government will run the test for free, so there's really no reason why you can't.
Wait, the federal government will run a.
Yeah, well, that's the requirement. So for me to say Sansouf and remove contain sulfite.
So, but you actually got it removed.
I had to provide the government a sample. They ran the test. They gave me the test back.
But you
approved the label.
But you got contain sulfites taken off the label.
Exactly.
That is
that process.
But that's crazy because I didn't even know that was possible. Well, and
but you have to provide a sample.
And I mean, the contained sulfite thing is bullshit anyways, and that's a whole different podcast on its own. Because
and there is a timing issue on that, I will say. That's why some winemakers don't do it.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I think that this is the first bottle I've ever seen that legitimately doesn't have contained sulfites on it, except for like, you know, the random European wines. Yeah. Someone will be like, here, I have four bottles of this. Take one home with you. And I'm like, cool.
Yeah, you just have to give them a sample. They run the test.
Wow.
I think this one was like less than, it wasn't measurable. It has to be less than 10, but ours was not measurable. And for your next podcast, because I know we're going to run out of time.
I'm like, you brought a Magnum. Usually we're like,
yeah.
I'm like, time is not of the issue now. I'm like, oh, Dougie, do you need some more? It is not 9:30 in the morning. It's like noon. Wait, look at how good I am now.
We're supposed to see people. Yeah.
I have a question real quick. If I can ask one.
Doug, if it's about fucking farting.
No, it's a legit.
From the and if it's about queefs, you're out.
But I have this wonderful privilege of being able to talk to the likes of all these beautiful wine professionals and winemakers. And
stop it. I'm right here.
I know. You're right here. But it is quite the privilege to be here next to Adam in particular.
No, but
all of you. It's fantastic. But one of the things I hear a lot from winemakers is that they may or may not necessarily like to be called natural or a natural winemaker. And I've actually had someone not too long ago from your neck of the woods that wanted to be called an honest winemaker. And even though he wasn't, he just had the fire vintage, as he called it, and he was under circumstances where he had to,
manipulate
the wine unto his liking. But you know, he wanted to be honest with his consumer. He made a fantastic product, it turns out, but he had some issues with that product. So that being said, we talked about honesty, we talked about natural, biodynamic, organic, all that. But you as a winemaker, what do you like to be known as to the regular consumer and to all of the above, like us, too?
Well, I mean, it's funny because, I mean, we've been doing this, again, since 2004, and we have not changed the way we made wines the whole time. And only since 2013, 14, have we really talked about our wines in terms of natural. So we've always had the idea that, hey, we care about how we're doing it, but most important, we're going to be transparent. We're going to tell you what we're doing. I mean, like Marissa just pointed out.
Oh! Whoa!
It's okay. I always say Adam Vervalis.
Yeah, no.
Oh, dear.
So it's fair.
Marissa just pointed out.
Also, it's funny that every time anyone gets a little bit drunk, they always call me Melissa. Like even my mother-in-law.
Are you saying no?
No,
I'm
no. It's funny.
Wine at 9:30 in the morning.
It's not 9:30. It's definitely
it's
after.
It's 8:30.
Yeah. It's 7 a.m. according to the clouds. When there's clouds out, I'm like, it could be any time in the morning.
Could be.
Anyways, go on. What did, as Melissa said.
We, in 2015, with our Twinkle Mouvedre, did have the need to find it. And so we removed that from the label. So I think most important for us is to be transparent about what we're doing and to make wines that are delicious.
So
hopefully, largely that falls within what we want to do, but occasionally it doesn't.
But still, like what Doug was saying, is like, I mean, do you want to be called an honest winemaker? Which I think, I don't know who asked you that, but I think that's a bad idea.
Well, that implies others aren't. So no, I would not want to necessarily be called an honest winemaker.
Also, I think that's such a, like, that's making it even worse. Like natural is already ambiguous. And then you're like, oh, I'm honest. I'm like, honest about what? Honest about like your personal life, honest about your finances.
And I spent 2 years trying to come up with a better word than natural, because we poured at Vin Natur in 2010, came back and told everybody, and everyone's like, what are you talking about? Like, what is Vin Natur? What is natural wine?
I love
what
Vin
is this? And so I was like, well, you're right. Natural is a really misused word in the food industry, and perhaps as the wine industry should come together and think of a better word, because really what they're trying to do is say that we're not just thinking about the vineyard any longer. We're thinking about what happens in the cellar as well.
I'm a big advocate of just calling it wine.
Well,
and
there
then
you go.
And then referring to everything else as conventional. And so it's not the you're a natural winemaker. It's that you're a winemaker, and that anyone who's doing all that crazy shit that we don't want to consume is conventional, and we label them. We don't label us.
That is like some punk rock.
I can get behind that, because it's like, label the people that are destroying the planet. Label perhaps a stylistic decision to design a wine versus steward a wine, because that's the other departure, which it's not to say designing something's a bad thing. There's plenty of illustrations in our daily lives that we love people that design things for us.
I'm married to one.
Well, there you go.
Like I was saying earlier, someone that does right for the consumer, it's been very, very important for me. Well, that has changed now that natural, quote unquote, natural wine is like a buzzword. And unfortunately, people like me using that word in my work now. But I've made a conscious effort in my writing for the consumer to, like, although I only promote basically natural and low intervention wines, I never call them that.
Mm-hmm.
It's wine. It's wine. And this should be the expectation. And like you said, like everyone else should be the exception. It's just really unfortunate that we're like 10% of the market. And so that's like the hard part, is like, because if we do like label them versus us, or like it shouldn't be us versus them anyways, but it's so hard to get 90% of the market to like have to, you know, to label all or to.
Well, it's hard to tell people
that
what they've been consuming for their entire lives.
No, but then also
is not
like,
what they think that they've been consuming. And that for us to all of a sudden be like, oh, you haven't actually been drinking what we consider wine. You've been drinking this thing called conventional wine.
And then people are like, what do you mean? And also the conventional wine is never going to bend to that. And at least not now.
Well, they're going to definitely appropriate the terminology.
They're going to appropriate the terminology for sure. But in the meantime, like something that winemakers can do like on the ground right now is something very simple that Tracy and Jared have been doing since 2003, which is just saying it's unfiltered, it's unfine, and like giving these words that people associate with natural wine without having to say it's natural wine, but so that the consumer can actually really understand what they're buying, because that's a huge problem. You know, I can't tell you how many poor people, I'm sorry I don't answer all of you, because you send me photos of wines from
did you
grocery.
Did you just apologize to poor people?
No.
Did you say I'm so sorry to poor people?
No. No. I meant like the poor people that like DM me. Okay, I was just like, I'm a poor person. I'm apologizing.
Oh, no, I'm joking.
Okay, no. I was saying the poor people that is this natural? And I'm like, you're in a Vons. It's not, like, I'm sorry, like, and you know, and the fact that so many people do have to wonder, like, they look at a wine, and while I can encourage everyone to shop at wine shops, I mean, that's my big thing. It's like, go to a wine shop. Absolutely. Save your money. Go to a wine shop. Talk to someone. The stock boy at fucking Gelson's does not know what a Sauvignon Blanc versus a Pinot Gris is, I promise you. So go to a wine shop. Please save your money. Go to a wine shop and buy something from someone that actually knows what they're talking about, and they're serving, you know, hopefully they're selling great wines. But the fact that so many people have to wonder, mm-hmm, what is in their wine? Is it a natural wine? Is it a low intervention wine? Or is this some bullshit? You know, in the meantime, this is the best way to combat that. You know, this is the best way to help the consumer understand what they're buying straight off the bat, like straight off the shelf. Like they can actually just grab it and be like, yes, like this is, I'm fine. I'm filtered. I know that those words are associated with this style of winemaking, and I now want to buy this. And I think that's extremely important.
Yeah, no, and do you think that this is a trend that we can see happening more and more, where people, because I would say one of my biggest gripes with the sort of the movement, if you will, is that like a lot of people talking about like design and stuff, like the label is cool and cute and you're like, yeah, look at this rad label, but there's like not a lot of information on the wine. It's just like this really rad label. And I'm wondering if more and more people are going to start realizing that, like, the more information that you have, this ability to put information on your label. Mm-hmm. So why aren't more and more people putting information, I suppose, instead of just calling your wine, like, you know, I'm a cool dude wine. And it's just like a picture.
Why isn't that the name of your wine?
I don't know.
I think that two things are going to happen. One, I think because of the pod, we're going to see winemakers, before they come here, show labels that are specifying what they do.
I hope so. That'd be great.
Yeah. I mean, like, but I do think more and more people in this kind of area of interest and focus will start sharing this, just because why wouldn't you? But from a, like, if we want to look 40 years or 30 years even down the road, I think what's going to happen is we all have these little computers in our hands every day.
And we
all have the ability to scan things now.
Oh, and yeah, a little QR code on there.
And there's a lot of effort because of our tech background. We know with companies like PepsiCo and others that are already, because of this whole generation we call the millennials.
Yeah.
The technology exists. It's already happening where within the food industry, labels will be scanned and the full list of ingredients and processing will be right there at your disposal.
Yeah.
And that's going to happen. It's just a matter of, you know, is it 10
well, it's
years
all, but it's also getting them out. I mean, and like as a writer for the consumer, it's also getting them, but it's a part of like getting people to even realize that this is a thing that they should be scanning and realizing that there's different things in their wine and like teaching them that it's
absolutely
not all just grapes, which is a huge kind of battle on its own, because I think that American drinking culture is extremely is further behind in terms of wine drinking than other cultures. I think we talked about this on the podcast with Quinn, so I don't want to repeat myself, but like, you know, Americans, you know, our wine drinking history is a lot is a lot newer. You know, we didn't start really drinking wine until like the 30s here in America. And like, I think that people just really do believe that most wine is just made with grapes and like there's nothing else to it. And so like bringing that consciousness and like having that tidal wave it needs to be like a tidal wave of like information so that people like really start to understand that like, it's not just grapes. I mean, it can just be grapes. There's great wines that are just
grapes. There's 300 other chemicals that might actually
be in your wine. Yeah.
No, I think.
You know how I make my wine?
He makes it.
We get grain alcohol, and then.
That's how he gets that 16% fucking zin.
Then we get some ultra purple. What's it called? Mega purple.
Mega purple. Don't get the name wrong.
It's actually just grape skins. I mean, you know, it sounds terrible, but.
And then we add mega purple to grain alcohol. And then we add powder tannins and acidity and oak chips. And then
just
we dilute it with
chips.
Water till it's exactly.
And then tartaric acid till the.
Yep. And that's it. Yep. And that's my one.
And then it's fucking juice. Zinfandel.
And then we call it, what did I say? This is
what? I think you called it fucking juice on the one.
I did call it fuck juice.
Just because it's like
really high alcohol. It's like 16%. But it's not made that way.
That's
it is made for fucking.
Water back.
That's exactly
and
right.
And it's Zinfandel.
Correct, and it's from Paso Robles.
Right, so.
It just, it happened.
Testament to you letting it do its thing.
Yeah.
Which is also a part of, you know, natural winemaking.
But again, I think at the end of the day, like so many things in life, if we're just transparent and honest, you know, we can all get along.
First of all, Tracy, thank you so much for joining us on the pod. I'm so happy to have you. You've been just, you're just wonderful in general. I've been very fortunate to drink a lot of your wines and get to hang out with you. And I'm very happy to have you today. And thank you for sharing so much about your winemaking and like your awesome labels and also like bringing us delicious wine.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for helping me kick off my birthday week.
Is it your birthday?
Oh my God, you're telling us now? Happy birthday.
Wait, is it, when's your birthday?
Monday.
Okay, okay.
It's the beginning.
Okay, wait, Monday. So
my mother spoiled me. I celebrate the whole week.
Wait, so, but Monday was your birthday? So
No, coming up. We're building. Oh. We're building.
When she means week, she means 14 days. She means a week before and a week
after. I'm like, wait.
No, it's the week before. You celebrate up to.
Oh.
The day of is the.
I'm a very. You know.
It's like a Hanukkah. It's like a Hanukkah birthday.
Yeah,
I'm
exactly.
A very anticlimactic birthday.
The actual day is the last day.
Okay, I like that. Well, happy birthday week.
Why, thank you.
Thank you so much for.
I'm going to be 28.
I know. Which is crazy because I really thought you were 23. And I was like, this is. Doug is fine. He's Instagramming about fucking fun parts.
Can't believe you had.
This.
Front farts.
Hashtag front farts. This episode is actually going to be called like interview with Tracy Brandt and also front farts.
War is bad.
Front farting is a thing.
People can fart from the front. So is that like you just like lean back? There's a hashtag front
all
fart.
All right, yes. Here's the finish. Front farts, war is bad, donking goat, great, labeling transparency, awesome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah.
I hope to God Adam edits this well.
Yeah, we're, I mean, yeah. We
goodbye.
Edit.
Yeah, good
bye.
Luck on that.
Goodbye.
Bye. Thank you,
goodbye.
Tracy.
Thank you, Tracy. Goodbye.